to continue with Zechariah chapter 8. We're going to do verses 1 through 8. It's a longer chapter. And I want to address a few things before we get into this. This would be part 13, I guess, of our survey of the prophets of the Restoration. And it's really, we're up to the middle of what we might call the sermon in chapter 7 and 8. And both chapters are dealing with the issue of fasting. It won't be quite as apparent in what we're going to cover right now because the reference to the fasting doesn't come up again till later in the chapter. But the whole texture of this discussion is driven by the question of fasting and some of the questions we addressed last time. Obviously, if the temple's being rebuilt and these fasts have to do with the destruction of Jerusalem, particularly the burning of the temple, why would we continue? And the real answer to that, at least in part, is in the question of why would you have an anniversary fast day? There's a problem that's being addressed that we could call a regulative principle issue. Those visions, the eight visions that were in Zechariah, gave us broad sweeping pictures of the history of the church from inside and out, from all different perspectives with respect to the New Testament church, and even with respect to the cutting off of the Jews and talking about their restoration, which is going to come up again in what we're going to look at tonight. This section of Zechariah, in some respects, is the instructional portion for the Jews, but it has application to all of us. It really addresses why, chapter 7 we saw, what was addressed is why they were brought under judgment in the first place. You know, the whole issue of fasting brought up that entire question of why is it God is afflicting them? What is going wrong here? And we're going to see that this theme continues because ultimately, as we'll see in this portion that we're going to cover tonight, the Jews are going to be scattered. We saw that hinted in the visions. Now it's going to become a little bit more explicit here. And yet there's also the hint of the regathering, which we've seen before. These are all important points to keep in mind. And these are all very important, are going to be very important, as we move forward into the prophetic part of the book. You might be thinking, if you're one of the Jews being addressed at this time, why go on? Why continue? If we're just going to fall again and be cut off, and this is just going to happen all over, why should we be concerned? And ultimately, what we're going to see in chapter 8, we'll see the beginning of this, but ultimately, the answer lies in this. Although the Jews are going to be cut off from the Christian church, particularly at the time of Jerusalem falling, there's a definitive diaspora. The fact is, there's a promise that at the end of time, that is, before the millennium, they're going to be regathered and brought back into the church. So that the building of the church, even though they're going to be cut off, it benefits them in the long run. And these chapters are dealing with some very important issues as to why a people are kept in covenant or cut off. And also, that's chapter 7, but in chapter 8, we see a lot of the underlying promises. Why is it that the people of God, even when they're afflicted, are brought back again? So we'll see some of those questions addressed. And they're very important questions. So placing these two chapters at the center of the book is really preparing the Jews at that time to receive the latter portion of the book with the understanding that they do have a role to play, even though they're going to be cut off. They're going to be cut off, but they still have a role to play. There's no presumption. They shouldn't be presumptive on their part. And Paul talks about this in Romans 11. God spared not the natural olive tree. You know, how much less is he going to spare the Gentiles? So there's something we can learn from this, and we should learn. And Paul actually uses this lesson, I think, somewhat in his discussion in Romans 11. So we're going to look at verses 1 through 8, and we're going to look at them in particular with respect to what's going to happen to the Jews down the road. And there are some interesting phrases in these first 8 verses that point out that what is in view is not simply something that's going to happen around the time of the prophet in the building of the temple, the second temple. Again, these are important points because in the sermon, the principles that are being enunciated, both the covenantal threats we saw in chapter 7, and also the underpinnings of the covenant that we're going to see in chapter 8 and the promises. These things are all applicable to the people of God at large. They're particularly applicable to the Jews because of the relation that they're going to bear to the New Testament era. But they should understand they have an interest in it. Right? They're not just building the temple for naught. Not only were they not all of the fasting, the anniversary day fasting, was that part of the problem, that they were not following God's commands when it came to his worship. But although God afflicts his people, he doesn't afflict them willingly. That is, he's always looking for their good. And we'll talk more about that. He's not doing it to cast them off utterly. They haven't been cut off. They weren't cut off, just like when they were sent into Babylon. They weren't cut off forever. The diaspora at the time of the fall of Jerusalem was not meant to be forever. It was meant to be for a time, a long time, but only a time. And ultimately, all of that comes back again and more if you understand the New Testament era as a period of time when the Church of God is going to be greatly enlarged beyond just Israel. So they have an interest in this, so they should. If you're faithful people of God, this should interest you. You know, if you've been afflicted and raised up again, this should interest you. You know, if you're afraid of the future, this should interest you. Whatever might concern you, if you're a Jew building the temple at that time, or really at our time, if you think about the proposition of being part of a small remnant that are very concerned with seeing that second temple rebuilt. Remember, a lot of people at that time remained, a lot of the Jews remained in Babylon. Remember that vision. Remember some of the other things that were said in the visions about those themes. Not everybody came back. We know that. Ezra and Nehemiah are clear. Not everyone comes back at this time. But looking down the road, in fact, there's reason to believe everyone will come back. Certainly the vast majority. It will be so close to everyone that you're not going to pay attention to the few maybe that don't. It will be that overwhelming. And that's the picture that's being presented. There's another theme that comes up here that I really want to address in verse 1. So as we move into verse 1 of chapter 8, begin with verse 1.
Zechariah 8, verse 1. Again, the word of the Lord of hosts came to me, saying.
Yeah, again, the word of the Lord of hosts came to me, saying. So we see there is a continuity here. It is continuing the theme, and it's part of that broader discussion of the fasting, which, as I say, we're not going to touch on right here in these 8 verses, but it comes up again at the end of the chapter, chapter 8. So it's going to come up again, and we need to understand this is in the context, the broader context of this question of fasting that we started to address last time. Now, again, Christ is portrayed as coming to the prophet. And I think it's interesting. We just, earlier, were doing some work in the Targums and the difference in Isaiah 8:5 in the Hebrew versus Isaiah 8:5 in the Targum, the Aramaic of the Targum, is the Hebrew just says the word of the Lord. Again, the word of the Lord came. Again, the Lord spoke. And the Targum said, again, the word of the Lord spoke. And they use a particular word in the Aramaic, memra. That was a rabbinic word that indicated that they, in fact, understood that the word of the Lord was not just an abstraction. Now, this is important for a couple of reasons. If we were talking about Plato, Plato said the difference between a philosopher and an orator is that a philosopher actually joins the internal idea, the internal word, to the external word. That's what makes him a true philosopher. And this is what we see God doing. You know, a rhetorician, an orator, they have the external word, but they have no internal word. They're not really trying to convey a meaning. But God is. And so this idea of the word of the Lord eventually becomes part of an apologetic in the early church and in the Gospels. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. John is answering Greek philosophy. And he's doing it using this concept that we have here. The word of the Lord of hosts came to me. So, the one who is coming to him is both the word of the Lord, what in Aramaic we would call the memra, the word, also, as Proverbs would say, the wisdom of God, the word of the Lord, and he's called the Lord of hosts because he is, in fact, the one who heads up all of the oversight of the creation, right? Everything, remember, has been put in subjection to him on behalf of the church. So he's running everything for the church. So here, he's presented both ways. Sort of is that, and I've talked about this before, I believe, that second power that the Jews knew was in heaven. There's a God that we don't see, that we might call the Father. And then there's a God who's revealed himself to us that we would call the Son, but the Targums refer to as the Word, an anthropomorphic concept. So there's already that idea that there's a condescension on the part of God when we talk about the word of the Lord as something personal rather than merely abstract. And here, the word of the Lord of hosts came to me. Again, we're seeing that abstraction and the concrete are coming together. God is not just an orator in Greek terms. He's a philosopher. He's the original philosopher. Now, the word of the Lord of hosts is really joining the wisdom and the sovereignty of God together in the person of Christ. And that's letting us know that he who is the wisdom of God is the one who is able to accomplish whatever he decrees. You know, he's the all-wise one. He's also the sovereign. He's running the show. Right? He's the Lord of hosts. So it's coming to the prophet again. That indicates that there's a condescension in divine revelation. We can't ascend up into heaven to know. He has to come to us, and he does again and again. Ultimately, the ultimate condescension of God is, in fact, Christ ascending and assuming a true humanity. All right, verse 2.
Zechariah 8, verse 2. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, I was jealous for Zion with great jealousy, and I was jealous for her with great fury.
Okay, so now, the word speaks with respect to his character as Lord of hosts. The Lord of hosts says, who is it? Well, the word of the Lord of hosts. Now, it's just the Lord of hosts. Why? Because God is active in history, but the activity of history centers around the church. And he's conducting all of the affairs of providence for the end of the church, for the church's well-being, and for the good and well-being of the people of God. Now, what he says is very interesting indeed. I was jealous for Zion with great jealousy, and I was jealous for her with great fury. Jealousy is a concept in the Bible that comes up, for example, in Numbers 5, when the woman who is suspected of adultery has to undergo a jealousy ordeal. The language of jealousy is implying that there is marriage. Marriage is the basis upon which jealousy, real jealousy, can arise. And only in that case, when there's a real solid relationship, when people who are not married, when they say, oh, I was jealous, blah, 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 you're not jealous. It's not really jealousy. There's no covenantal basis for a concern. Right? You need betrothal, you need marriage, you need covenant. So there's pointing out a covenant of marriage kind of affection which God has toward his church. And he's undertaking in this chapter really a series of considerations that are meant to encourage the people of God. Remember, chapter 7 was pretty bleak. It was pointing to the fact that it was not going to go well for them. They were going to be scattered. The Jews are going to be scattered. That they were going to harden their hearts again, that it wasn't going to get better for them. At that point, God was going to shatter and scatter them. So, there are a couple of things. There is encouragement here already in the fact that the Lord himself is speaking. His word is going to stand. He's not going to not be heard by his people, his church. And that's certainly encouraging. He's still talking. Even though he said they're going to be cast off, he doesn't stop there. It's not the end of the word, right? He doesn't say it's going to finish with your dispersion. Instead, he brings about an explanation as to what's going on that actually should be taken as encouragement. There's an underlying assumption here that the church's security is grounded in God's free covenant love. He entered into this marital relation that he's going to see through to the end. And it's this jealousy, although this is why God afflicts the church. Remember, he's afflicting, but not willingly. But this jealousy is also telling us why the church is not destroyed. You're not jealous if there isn't really this covenantal love. Right? You're not really jealous. The fact that God is jealous tells you that there is this covenant bond, and he's very concerned. And the jealousy drives him to do great and terrible things, to bring the church around. But he does so, we should understand, out of a deep love for his people. Jealousy, properly understood, is actually a legitimate expression of a deep love which has been rightfully offended. It's been righteously offended. Conversely, this also has implications for the other people. Remember, God isn't just smacking people down as if some big cosmic hand descends out of the sky. God moves the enemies of the Jews, the enemies of the church throughout history, to afflict his people. But the fact that this affliction arises out of jealousy should make those who are the rod of his affliction very, very careful about what they're doing. They should beware and remember that when they strike at the people of God, they're striking at the apple of his eye. Remember that term occurs in Zechariah. So, you may hear jealousy and it may sound to you all kinds of negative, but there's something very positive if the Jews stopped and thought about this. Something very solid that God is the one who is jealous about this. He's not going to let them go that easily. He's not going to let them go out and break off their covenant with him. It's just not going to happen. All right, verse 3.
Zechariah 8, verse 3. Thus saith the Lord, I'm returned unto Zion, and will dwell in the midst of Jerusalem, and Jerusalem shall be called a city of true and the mountain of the Lord of hosts, the holy mountain.
Okay, so the comment continues, and this is really a second reason for the people of God to hope. We continue saying, look, I'm returned unto Zion. I'm going to dwell in the midst of Jerusalem. Jerusalem called a city of truth, the mountain of the Lord of hosts, the holy mountain. So what is he saying? He's saying, I've returned. He's returned to them. Right? Well, how do we know he's returned to them? Some of them, at least, have come back from captivity. They're rebuilding Jerusalem. They're rebuilding the temple. What do you mean, how do we know? Yes, you should know if you're hearing this. God has returned. You wouldn't have come back from captivity if the Lord had not returned unto you. You know, Zion is the church. He's returned to the church. And he goes on to say, he will dwell among them. He'll restore their former dignity and privileges. That's what he's saying. So if the return is evidenced by their return from captivity, God's return to them because they've returned from captivity, what they can derive from this next statement, when he says, and I will dwell in the midst of Jerusalem, is in fact that they're going to be successful in rebuilding the temple. I mean, that's the first line on the horizon, prophetically. That gives them assurance that they're going to be successful. Now, that points to the New Testament era. It points to the millennium. It points to the consummation. But it's the same idea. God, the Lord, is dwelling in the midst of Jerusalem, the people of God, the church. And that's truth that they can, in fact, understand and appreciate at that time. Now, in the Restoration, Jerusalem, which is a type of the church, and particularly, as we're going to see in a moment, is in fact looking even further out to the millennial church. Jerusalem shall be called a city of truth. What that tells us is that her former idolatry, the corrupting of the worship, the things that had brought the judgment in the first place, remember, that's a big part of chapter 7. The Jews are in trouble with God. They've been afflicted. They've been thrown into captivity because of their violation of what we would call the regulative principle. They decided to worship God in a way he had not commanded. And it had a number of manifestations that went so far as they were going to worship God in a way he had not commanded, even in celebrating an anniversary fast day. Not just one, they multiply these days. So in place of the idolatry, the corrupting of worship, there's going to be reformation and fidelity to the truth. Now, again, this points to what is happening for a time at the rebuilding of the Second Temple. It points, that's the type, the fulfillment in Christ, and ultimately that fulfillment in Christ is expressed in his body, the church, during the millennial age. Right? Jerusalem during the millennial age, the church during the millennial age, will be called the city of truth. We're not going to have all of that. Why are these issues, what some people call the worship wars, why are they so important? Why should we be so adamant and serious about it? There's not going to be a millennium with a bunch of hymn singing, organ grinding, holy day celebrating people who think they're Presbyterian or Reformed. It's not going to happen that way. We're never going to get there. Of course, you know, your average run-of-the-mill, stuck-in-the-mud amillennialist doesn't even think we're going there. But that's the point of Zechariah's prophecy. We need to look through those prophetic horizons. There's one fulfillment, which is that Jerusalem will be a city of truth, but there's several horizons of that fulfillment. All right, there's the typical, the antitype. There is Christ and his body. And there is the first and the second coming. So there's different degrees of realization going on here. But the result is this. The people of God shall become holy, and this holy people shall be a great kingdom, the mountain of the Lord of hosts. Now I want to look at Daniel 2, verses 44 and 45 here. Because that's where this idea, if we want to understand a little bit better the mountain of the Lord of hosts, we need to have a little bit better sense of the context at this time. So Daniel 2.
Daniel 2, 44 and 45. And in the days of these kings shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom, which shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people, but it shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. For as much as thou sawest that the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, that it break in pieces the iron, the brass, the clay, the silver, and the gold, the great God hath made known to the king what shall come to pass hereafter. And the dream is certain, and the interpretation thereof is sure.
So, the image of the mountain of the Lord, it's very prominent in the eschatological accounts in the prophets, and it's very clear in terms of Daniel that what is happening is the New Testament church, the kingdom of Christ, that's going to absorb those four kingdoms that Nebuchadnezzar saw in his dream, his vision. It's going to absorb them. It's going to take over. Well, that's what Zechariah is talking about. He's seeing the same thing here now, the mountain of the Lord of hosts. And he says it's a holy mountain. Right? Remember, holiness becometh thy dwelling place. God is dwelling among the holy people. And this talks about sanctification. It's talking about that typical sanctification under the Mosaic economy, the antitype in Christ, and then really the fullness of that in the body of Christ, particularly during what we call the millennium. Now, it's also important, I think, to understand here that this is not merely describing some temporal enlargement of the Jewish nation. You could take it that way, but it doesn't really answer to anything that has happened at this point or around this time. It's looking for a permanent enlargement of the New Testament church. Verse 4.
Zechariah 8, verse 4. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, there shall yet old men and old women dwell in the streets of Jerusalem, and every man with his staff in his hand for very age.
Okay, so here's another reason for encouragement. Think of these as reasons God is giving. You know, he's just told them that they're going to be scattered to the winds at the end of chapter 7. And now he's saying, but don't be discouraged. Why? Well, that's not the end of the story. It might be discouraging. Right? The fall of man could have really been discouraging. If the Bible stopped at Genesis 3... it would be terribly discouraging. We would have every reason to despair. But it doesn't. And the story doesn't stop at the end of chapter 7 in this continuation of the sermon. This time, and we have to remember, the time that's being pointed out is the time when Jerusalem has become the city of truth, the mountain of the Lord of hosts, the holy mountain, and so on. We're told that at that time, there shall yet old men and old women dwell in the streets of Jerusalem, and every man with a staff in his hand for very age, or for multitude of days, number of days. So the picture is that at this time, there's going to be an increase of prosperity, and men and women are going to live to an old age in relative peace. Now, this is something that was discussed in Isaiah. Isaiah talked about the millennium and talks about people living to be old. Right? And that's really what's in view here, ultimately, is that people are going to live to be old. This is temporal peace. But, you know, the holiness is going to bring temporal peace as well as spiritual peace. That's part of what he's saying. Remember, with sin came judgment and affliction, captivity. And in fact, we know that during this time, nobody was safe in the streets. We can see this if we look at Lamentations 2, verse 21, and Lamentations 5, verses 11 through 14.
Lamentations 2, verse 21. The young and the old lie on the ground in the streets. My virgins and my young men are fallen by the sword. Thou hast slain them in the day of thine anger. Thou hast killed and not pitied.
Lamentations 5:11-14, they ravish the women in Zion and the maids in the cities of Judah. Princes are hanged up by their hand. The faces of elders were not honored. They took the young men to grind, and the children fell under the wood. The elders have ceased from the gate, the young men from their music.
Okay, so that's Jeremiah's lamentation over what? The people going into captivity at Babylon. Now Zechariah is telling them, look, this is going to be a time, the reverse of that. Okay, it's going to be very different. We're looking forward to something very different. People will reconcile to God, experience outward prosperity. At least to a degree, that is subservient to the spiritual good. Wouldn't do you any good to be more prosperous and would be good for you spiritually. That wouldn't be good for you. But more holiness allows for greater latitude of temporal comfort among the people of God. The more holy you are, the more you can actually withstand temporal comfort without being spun off into some direction where you're going to need to be chastised or afflicted. And so the picture here is there's a time that's going to come when the holiness and the prosperity are going to go hand in hand. Right? So the greater the holiness, the greater the prosperity you can absorb without forgetting God. And that, again, is pointing to the millennium, when the church is at peace, there's great prosperity, temporally and spiritually, because there's great holiness among the people. Now, this vision continues in verse 5.
The streets of the city shall be full of boys and girls playing in the streets thereof.
Okay, so adding to the vision of the previous verse, now we see children laughing, playing in the streets. It's interesting, I think, here to note that, and the Jews would have understood this very well, happy children and a lot of children and comfortable old age are both of them marks of a prosperous community. Right? War, famine, and pestilence tend to be hardest on those segments of a society. This stands in contrast to the vision of judgment, which we see, for example, if we look at Psalm 78, verses 62 to 64. It's a very different picture that the psalmist paints in Psalm 78. Verse 62 to 64.
Psalm 78, verses 62 through 64. He gave his people over also under the sword, was wroth with his inheritance. The fire consumed their young men, and their maidens were not given to marriage. Their priests fell by the sword, and their widows made no lamentation.
Okay, so, in contrast to that, again, what are we looking for? Well, these verses, I think, especially, are talking about, first of all, the enlargement of the church under the New Testament, but especially during what we call the millennium. We're going to see more of this in the prophetic portion, the latter portion of Zechariah. It's going to become a lot more clear in that section. But this is already bringing this out. It's already holding forth this hope. But don't not build the temple just because the Jews are going to be cast off again. It's not going to be total and final. And by the way, there is something very grand at the end of all of this. Verse 6.
Zechariah 8, verse 6. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, if it be marvelous in the eyes of the remnant of this people in these days, should it also be marvelous in my eyes, saith the Lord of hosts.
Well, what, again, this is another reason. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, right? He's talking to him again. Here's another reason. What is it? Well, look. You might be tempted to judge the promises of God by some other measure than God, but he's warning you against that. And it might seem very hard to believe. Why? Well, again, think about their position. You might think it's going to be very hard to see this come to pass, and yet it's going to come to pass. You know, you may be part of a small remnant of people, of the people of God, standing in Jerusalem, rebuilding the temple. And from your vantage point, to hear about this kind of enlargement and prosperity and peace and holiness and all of that, that could seem to be impossible. But just when you're about to think it's impossible, through the prophet, God says, look, tell the people, if you're thinking that way, don't. You know, I know you're thinking that way. But our eyes are directed in this verse to look away from the impediments toward God, with whom all things are possible. Furthermore, you know, he's been laying the groundwork here in giving these promises and alluding to these things that are going to happen. Why are these things important? Because the promises of God are sure. He's not going to miscarry in this. He hasn't heretofore. He's not going to now. Right? He's telling you, I know the end from the beginning. I know what's happened before, and I'm telling you why. That's what this sermon is. I'm telling you why it happened and why it's going to happen again. But I'm also telling you the other side, that it's not forever and it won't be again. You know, you can focus on that, but that's your problem. People of God, that's your problem. You focus on that and not on the promises that God has given. You're not listening to what he's saying as to why this happens. It happens because he's jealous. And the only reason he's jealous is because he loves you with an everlasting love. If you're the people of God, if you're the church of God, that's an unwavering commitment that God has in his people. And you need to know this. It's not going to be forever. Right. Now, that the way this is being presented should really be reminding you of the fact that within the covenant, there are blessings and there are cursings. And what Israel is going through and what they've gone through at various times are covenantal cursings. But the fact that they're covenantal cursings tells us that there's a covenant. The jealousy ordeal is a jealousy ordeal precisely because there's a covenant. Verse 7.
Zechariah 8, verse 7. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, Behold, I will save my people from the east country and from the west country.
Yeah, from the east country and from the west country. The Hebrew there for west country really says the country of the going down of the sun. It's a little bit more elaborate. And if it wasn't clear before in this and the next verse, this prophecy, prediction, or whatever is going on here is clearly moving beyond the time of the prophet and the people to whom he's speaking. Now, by east and west, what should be understood are all parts of the world. All parts of the world are encompassed in that. We see that if we look at Psalm 113:3, Psalm 50, verse 1, and Malachi 1, verse 11. Get a sense of
Psalm 113, verse 3. From the rising of the sun unto the going down of the same, the Lord's name is to be praised.
From the rising of the sun to the going down of the same. Psalm 50, verse 1.
Psalm 50, verse 1. The mighty God, even the Lord, hath spoken and called the earth from the rising of the sun unto the going down thereof.
From the rising of the sun to the going down thereof. Again, from east to the west. Malachi 1:11.
Sun, even unto the going down of the same, my name shall be great among the Gentiles, and in every place incense shall be offered unto my name, and a pure offering. For my name shall be great among the heathen, saith the Lord of hosts.
Okay. Now, when we get to Malachi, we're going to talk about that verse, but it's already being alluded to a little bit here with the way this is being phrased, from the east country even to the country of the going down of the sun. That's talking about all the parts of the world. Now, why is that important? Here's why. And this is why we know this is already moving beyond the time of the prophet. The only dispersion of the Jews at the time of this prediction had been to the east in Babylon. Maybe we could say to the south in Egypt. But this idea that there was some dispersion of the Jews into the west, it just doesn't stand. There was no dispersion into the west. That does not happen now. What is being predicted here then is a more general diaspora of the Jews into all of the earth, because that is a necessary condition for the fulfillment of this prophecy, to save them from that condition and estate. Now, that does not occur until the fall of Jerusalem. Hundreds of years later. So we're not looking at something that is going on at the time of Zechariah or the people at that time. There's a lot that has to happen. You know, first they have to be dispersed all throughout the world, and then there has to be a regathering. And as we saw before, that this gathering is not, it's not just an increase of the nation of Israel. It's not just pointing to Israel, although Israel is at the center of this. And here I think we do have a promise that we could call a promise of the restoration of the Jews at some future point, a time when, remember, if we look at the other reasons that have been given, this restoration of the Jews is going to come at a time when the church is greatly enlarged and when it is in a state of peace and prosperity.
Hmm? This says in Malachi 1:11, it says, from the rising of the sun even to the going down of the same.
Yeah.
That's referring to Britain, correct?
To what?
Britain. Wasn't it said at one time that in England, you know, the sun never set on England? Because
it's talking about the church. It's talking about... Yeah, there's not going to be any place where the church has not spread. Right, the British Empire said that there was not there was never a time when the sun set in the British Empire, because wherever it was setting, there was some place it was rising. It was so widespread, and that I do think has some bearing on why. Something like the Solemn League and Covenant is such an important consideration when we talk about the Commonwealth of Nations that come out of Britain. When we talk about what's going to happen at the time of the millennium, when the churches are actually becoming more faithful and the nations are being converted. Okay. But that's not what that's talking about. That application-wise... perhaps. Right. So this is a time that is being talked about here, when God saves his people from the east and west, when the New Testament church, it's got to be after the diaspora, is enlarged. It's enlarged into a holy mountain, and it's claiming the title of the city of truth and filling the earth. I mean, that's really what we're looking at here. You know, again, that tells us that the restoration of the Jews is going to be very close, timing-wise, to the millennium. Right, in verse 8.
Zechariah 8, verse 8. And I will bring them, and they shall dwell in the midst of Jerusalem, and they shall be my people, and I will be their God in truth and in righteousness.
Okay, so now the Jews are being encouraged in Zechariah's day to take comfort in the promise, because their work, the work they're doing, is needed for the progression that's being described. Right, what is the progression? Well, Christ must come. Jerusalem has to be destroyed. The Jews have to be scattered so that in due time, they can be regathered from all over and grafted in again. And what does he say? He says, I will bring them, or I will lead them. Hebrew can mean I will lead them. From the lands of their scattering, that is, I will lead them and bring them to where? To Jerusalem. To the church. Jerusalem is a type of the New Testament church. They're going to be brought in. Now, here is almost certainly a promise of the restoration of the Jews, and not just of the Jews, but to their own land. There's been discussion over the history of the church as to whether or not the conversion of the Jews would entail them returning to their own land. And I think this is one of these places where we can begin to say, yes, it appears that there is something to this. Now, I would add to that that the fact is, we're talking about nations covenanting and renewing covenant. Well, then that really points to the reestablishing of Israel as a nation in order to this occurring. All right. The regathering is to be part of the spiritual theocracy that is to be built in the latter days. So it's not merely political restoration. But look at the language. And here's this language I think is very important, not only to understand why we should see the Jews returning to their own land, but also I think this has bearing on why the question about the British Empire and the Psalm, League, and Covenant even have bearing on this. Right? The restoration of the Jews is to be accompanied with a covenant renewal. There's been a jealousy ordeal, and there has to be a covenant renewal. So the final phrase of the verse points to more than a temporal restoration. It's going to be spiritual, in truth and righteousness. Right? That's the very last few words here. The covenant is the foundation of the church of God under the Old and the New Testament. And that covenant that God made with the church is a basis for them taking hold again of this covenant through what we would call social covenanting. Now, this is a time which was spoken of by the earlier prophets. For example, if we look at Isaiah 19, verses 18 to 25.
Language of Canaan, and swear to the Lord of hosts, one shall be called the city of destruction. In that day shall there be an altar to the Lord in the midst of the land of Egypt, and a pillar at the border thereof to the Lord. And it shall be for a sign and for a witness unto the Lord of hosts in the land of Egypt. For they shall cry unto the Lord because of the oppressors, and he shall send them a Savior, and a great one, and he shall deliver them. And the Lord shall be known to Egypt, and the Egyptians shall know the Lord in that day, and shall do sacrifice and oblation. Yea, they shall vow a vow unto the Lord and perform it. And the Lord shall smite Egypt, he shall smite and heal it. And they shall return even to the Lord, and he shall be entreated of them and shall heal them. In that day shall there be a highway out of Egypt to Assyria, and the Assyrian shall come into Egypt, and the Egyptian into Assyria, and the Egyptians shall serve with the Assyrians. In that day shall Israel be the third with Egypt and with Assyria, even a blessing in the midst of the land, whom the Lord of hosts shall bless, saying, Blessed be Egypt my people, and Assyria the work of my hands, and Israel my inheritance.
So the idea that Israel is going to be a third part with Egypt and Assyria tells us that they're all covenanting at the same time. And here we have a covenant renewal on the part of the Jews, as they're being restored at the time, around the time that we call the millennial era. They represent one part of the world. Right? And perhaps we have in the other two representations of two other portions of the world. But the fact is that at this time, during the millennium, there's going to be this covenanting going on in all parts. It's still future. What's talked about here is still future. What's talked about in verse 8. Nonetheless, the point of the prophet up to this verse is to encourage the Jews to keep working, keep rebuilding that temple, because what they're doing is a precursor to the future restoration. They're holding forth what is to come. Okay, so next time we'll continue going over the final verses in this chapter 8, verses 9 through 23. I think we should be able to get through all of them. And we will look at the rest of this sermon before we move into the prophetic part of the book.